Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Socks, a Catholic book blogger, and today we have with us Sean McAfee, who was raised Protestant, but at 24 he experienced a profound conversion to the Catholic Church with the writings of James Cardinal Gibbons and Modern Apologists. He's the author of Filling Our Father's House from Sophia Institute Press, among other books, and holds a master's in dogmatic theology. Sean is the founder and editor of EpicPew.com and contributes to many online Catholic resources. Today, Sean is here to talk about his latest book from Catholic Answers Press, entitled Reform Yourself, How to Pray, Find Peace, and Grow in Faith with the Saints of the Counter-Reformation. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you, Pete. I'm glad to be with you once more.
Awesome. Great stuff. So, I got to tell you, I really like this book, and I liked it because it was more than just a book about the Reformation. There's been a lot of books out this past 12 months about the Reformation due to the anniversary. And what is different about yours, and I liked about it, is that the title alludes to something different. It's talking about the Reformation of the reader. So what led you to write this book?
Oh, great question. This book got started whenever I finished my second book, which was my last book I completed in 2016, and that was just on the saint that's actually still included in this book, St. Robert Bellarmine. And it's a self-titled book, St. Robert Bellarmine, and really that was more of a biographical narrative. But I read like three or four books about the saint whenever I was developing the content for that. And as soon as I was done, I wanted to keep on reading about other saints that St. Robert Bellarmine interacted with in his life and while he was a cardinal. So, for example, he was the spiritual director to St. Aloysius Gonzaga. He exchanged letters whenever he was working in Rome with St. Philip Neri, who was just getting on the starting his founding the Oratory, the Congregation of the Oratory. And he exchanged letters with Cardinal Borromeo up in the Diocese of Milan, who was leading the efforts on carrying out the reforms of the Council of Trent. So it was just fascinating to me that there was one saint, and not just one saint in the Counter-Reformation, but I mean, let's say like a dozen who all knew each other. They corresponded. They supported each other. They used each other's resources. Some of them were each other's spiritual guides and confessors. And I was just in awe of all that. So the more my interest peaked, the more, you know, this kind of happens, I guess, with writers. I hope I'm not the only one. But the more my interest was piqued, I thought maybe readers might, you know, their interest might be piqued as well. And so it seemed a fortuitous occasion about a year ago for me to present this to a few different publishers and Catholic Answers. We had a common vision, and what we wanted to form, like you alluded to, was not just a biographical narrative of several saints, but we wanted to give readers something different, something practical, something that talked about what these saints did and how to be just like them, and kind of more along those lines to highlight what the church really needed and what it still continues to need today is souls that are driven towards conversion to Christ in a constant state. And like Paul says, he says, put on the new man. We're called every day to put on the new man, to convert continuously. And what a lot of the saints have written about is to say, you know, before you go reforming everybody else or every other institution, start with your own soul. And that's the way you can lead the church to perfection.
Exactly. I've written about it myself in some articles I've written, is that before you go out to evangelize everybody else, you need to evangelize yourself. So kudos on including that in this book, Sean. And it seems pretty obvious, but I think it bears mentioning that we really should kind of have an idea of what the faith is about before we go trying to share it with others, correct?
Yeah, that's one thing. I'm developing a new book on social media and the magisterium, and it's something I kind of cover in a couple sections, or at least allude to in this book, especially since, you know, a lot of these reformers had to do with apologetics, you know, like you said, and that's the bottom line is, you know, don't go trying to teach somebody else what the church teaches until fully, one, you've embraced it. But if you're going to evangelize others, if you're going to give others direction on spiritual content or morality or any sort of direction in that, that nature, you're going to want to make sure you can walk the walk before you talk the talk to somebody else.
Right. And it almost seems kind of funny. Well, not funny, but it seems to happen a lot where, especially with converts, you know, myself included, we get all pumped up and energized after we convert, and we're all ready to run out and spread the news, and we really don't know what we're talking about.
yeah, to a degree. I think we need to filter that sort of excitement. I mean, I think everybody, you know, has something great to share. If you can't explain, you know, the Quinque Valle, you know, in part two, section one of St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa, you know, if you can't explain that in great detail, you know, to do it justice, what you can do is at least talk about your own conversion. You mm-hmm. can start there, and you can get the practice of talking about something you're familiar with, something you're intimately involved with. And then, as I always tell this to people, as soon as you have developed, you know, the conversation skills and the confidence to share those sides of the spiritual life, then you can start talking about the more complicated things that you need to be a lot more precise on.
Right on. So I want to share this quote from the introduction where you say, "It is said that if you want to become a saint, you must read the saints. But I say, if you want to become a saint, you must do more than read. You must study the saints," end quote. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that seems a bit direct. I try to come off a lot more suggestive in my writing instead of just telling somebody, you know, like to me, when you read that, my finger's pointing at the reader. No. So what I mean by that is you know, I'll tell you a secret, and this is something I had in a draft of my introduction. I totally deleted it, and I'm kind of going against my protocol here by mentioning this to you, but I did not like reading about the saints for the longest time until I got started on writing about the saints. And in order to write about the saints, I had to study them. I couldn't just regurgitate what, you know, Antonio Galonio wrote about St. Philip Neri. You know, he's his chief biographer. I didn't just want to regurgitate all these stories. I mean, why would I do that? I would just tell you, go read his book, right? So as an author, I wanted to offer something a bit better. And in order to develop those, I guess, those skills and those communication bits and pieces as an author, I needed to actually get into the life of these saints. But as I did that, I was growing spiritually as well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the first order of practice for me is to, like we were talking about earlier, is to reform myself and then share those, you know, bits of knowledge and wisdom with everybody else. And to me, that's where I think the conversation was lacking. Whenever people were like, "Okay, hey, Sean, you know, I don't know if you ever thought about it, but you need to go pick up Butler's Lives of the Saints and just get started reading." You know, I needed more than that. I don't just need to get started reading. I mean, everybody should know the evidence is for God, but you don't just tell anybody, "Hey, go read St. Thomas Aquinas." It's like, where do you start? You know, and then and then what's the curriculum? You know, what are you reading? What are you reading about? And does it serve any purpose? Do you know what you're going to read before you read it? You know. So as I think I said in the dedication there, I didn't write this book from page one to the end. I got started reading about St. Robert Bellarmine, and my interest in all of these saints grew. And the more that I wanted to, the more that I became inspired by them, like St. Aloysius Gonzaga, you know, young man died at 23, accomplished more in morality than I'll ever accomplish in my life. But I'm the one with the degrees. I'm the one with the books. I'm the one with the blogs. He never did anything like that, right? But he touched more lives, you know. So anyways, to make a long story short, I wanted to become more like them. And in order to become more like them, I didn't just need to read about them. I need to study them. I need to study what exactly, you know, how did they pray? What were the techniques? How did St. Pius V grow to promote the rosary? What was his chief ambition there? You know, what did St. Francis de Sales do to convert 100,000 Genevans? You know, what was St. Robert Bellarmine's secret to writing, you know, 100 million words or more in his lifetime? You know, milestones that I'll never touch. What were the basic secrets about this? You know, and these are things that you have to kind of think and get analytical about. They're not just gonna, there's not a book about any of this. And so that really is, you know, that was the message. And that's really what the central theme of the rest of the book is, you know, okay, let's talk about some of these saints, and let's talk about what their, you know, their accomplishments are, and some of the fun stories that we have to tell. And some of the readers might be familiar with, mm-hmm. others they'll be totally oblivious of, and they'll be shocked about.
Right.
But, you know, I wanted to bring out, you know, what can we learn inside the details, you know, inside the lines of the pages of their biographies, you know, what made them unique and effective. And in order to do that, took a long time to answer the question, but in order to do that, we need to study them, not just go and read all the facts about them.
Right. So one more question I have while we're in this first segment, as we're setting up our conversation as we move forward. You included 10 saints in the book. How did you determine which saints you wanted to include?
I drew their names from a hat.
That's logical, actually. That's pretty good.
No, it was tough. I had to think, okay, I got an assignment to do a book about the Counter-Reformation. In order to make this a feasible book to publish and, you know, an entertaining read, you know, and something that readers are really going to be filled by, I put a lot of care into who I chose, right? I mean, there's mm-hmm. some Counter-Reformers that I left out. And arguably I narrowed the historical timeline. I left it to mostly Central Europe. I left it to probably the cutoff was probably the end of the 16th century. Even though some of them survived past that, most of their work was done within the 16th century, you know, right around the Council of Trent and Trent being carried out and executed. So I wanted people that either really had a chief involvement in the reform of the church or an order and were kind of more, I guess, like I said, centered around the 16th century. At the same time, I couldn't have all the apologists, right? I mean, right. This book is with Catholic answers. I could have made a book about, you know, how the apologists won the Counter-Reformation or something. That would have been, you know, a decent title, but you know, I really was, like I said, I really wanted to keep the purpose of this book in mind. And the purpose of the book was, you know, self-development. It kind of falls under like kind of a self-help umbrella, but this is like spiritual guidance and development. And so in order to do that, the spiritual life has so many dynamics. And the 16th century Catholics, I mean, they had so many different problems. I mean, the church is really in turmoil. It really can't be underestimated how bad it was, just as a matter of leadership and accountability. And these saints that really, the saints that really reformed the church and reformed the hearts and minds of people, they had so many different qualities that Catholics today really need to readopt or rediscover. And so what I did was after kind of getting that date range and the kind of the geographical area of concentration, I created more or less a pageant of different types of saints as well. And so everybody from St. Robert Bellarmine and the Pope Pius V to somebody, you know, 23 who never wrote a book or, you know, talked to a large audience, somebody like St. Aloysius Gonzaga mm-hmm. are included cover to cover there.
Awesome. And we're going to get back into some of those saints when we come back. Right now, we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Faith with the saints of the Counter-Reformation. And last segment, Sean, we talked about basically how the book came to be. So now I'd like to get into the nuts and bolts of it a bit and talk about a few of these saints. And let's start with St. Francis de Sales. You mentioned him last segment. And by the way, I love your subtitles to each chapter. The subtitle of this one is St. Francis de Sales, the Apologist Next Door. So give us an overview of this great saint.
I think somebody made fun of that. Oh, it was on actually Catholic Answers Live, Cy Kellett. And not to say he made fun of it, but he poked what I didn't even see was a, I guess, kind of a pun there. Where, you know, he went door to door. Well, he said, you know, kind of it's like he's a door to door salesman. So the salesman next door. So St. Francis de Sales, he's a guy right out of northern Italy who ended up what he did was he had a real change of heart. He went to business school, he went to law school right here in northern Italy. I think he went to the University of Padova, and he got a religious vocation after so many years. Is like a lot of these Counter-Reformation saints, I hope I'm able to talk a little bit more to it later. Mm-hmm. A lot of these saints, the males, their fathers, you know, especially if they were first born, really resisted their religious vocation because it really implied a lot for the family. Just as a matter of inheritance and the well-being of the rest of the family, you know, it was a real serious decision. It's not something you could get back. So, St. Francis de Sales, over the course of a few years, had to really discern hard if he was willing to, you know, give up, you know, the family tradition of lawyering or go for a religious vocation. Obviously, we know he chose the religious vocation, and easy to say, it was the right choice. St. Francis de Sales, what I think was really special about him, how did he convert 100,000 Genevans, estimated, is he, I say in the book, he didn't reinvent the wheel. You know, I think one thing I said a few weeks ago was there's no Chuck Norrises in the Counter-Reformation. There's no lone wolves.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, and St. Francis de Sales is the champion of that notion, is that he didn't reinvent the wheel of apologetics. What he says, and I quote this in the book, is that he says, what did I do? What made me so effective whenever I was preaching to the Genevans is I used the Bible and the text of St. Robert Bellarmine as my sole content. And so what I'm getting at is that he didn't go and read, you know, 100 books and form his own arguments. You know, he went and got the existing works of people who have already proven themselves to be effective on modern apologetics issues and presented those to these people, you know. So a lot like Catholic Answers and how Carl Keating got the whole apostolate started. Mm-hmm. He made tracts and slipped those under the Genevans' door at night, inviting them to Mass, providing answers, you know, quick and pithy answers on modern issues, and then gave them an invite to Mass. Also, the other key thing that he did that really kind of set him apart was his real interpersonal dialogue. So he's very famous, not just for converting a lot of people, but a lot of really high status people. He converted princes and lords and I think everybody other than a king. And he, you know, like now we kind of read about the churches that are converting. He would bring entire parishes back from Calvinism and set up the altar and, you know, reunite the church with Rome. And he made all these accomplishments because, as well as his smarts and his gifts in apologetics, he maintained a personal love of all of these people that he was trying to convert. So, you know, as they say, you know, you want to win the soul, not the argument. He's a champion of that. He really worked over the course of decades to do all of this, even with the hardest of hearts. So that kind of perseverance and that endurance and investing in the person and not just the, you know, the will to win arguments is really what, to me, made St. Francis de Sales so effective and, you know, worthy of our adoration and our, imitation of him.
Right. And I always looked at St. Francis de Sales in my own ministry with what I do here on the podcast and reviewing books. You know, his skills as a communicator, as you said, is what kind of brought so many people to the faith through him because of his ability to communicate. And you include in here some key tips, and I like to go over those a bit. And you say, and I'll just go down through the list. Read at a pace that is sufficient for your level of study. Keep notes. Make use of reference guides, compendiums, and commentaries. and try to enjoy what you read. And I think that's the key one there, is trying to enjoy what you read.
Yeah. Yeah, no, nothing. I'm glad you pointed that. I don't have the book in front of me, actually. But yeah, the last one, I think, is really the key to all the others, is you can read as much as you want and fall asleep within 5 minutes. But, scientists have proven this over the past several decades, is our bodies, our cognitive sense retains more with the amount of, we'll say enjoyment that we're being brought, or, the amount of, enjoyment does suffice it to say, but yeah.
Now, one of the things you talked about when you answered the last question, I want to give you an opportunity to expand upon that thought, because you had hoped I brought it up, so before I forget to bring it up again, is all these saints and the difficulty they had in this decision process of, okay, I'm going to walk away from what my family has traditionally done, and I'm going to do this. And, at that time, some people probably thought they were pretty crazy for, leaving the tradition of lawyers in the family or to take up this mantle of religious life, so to speak. So can you speak to those difficulties?
Yeah. And to get a framework for what we're talking about here, when we look at the philosophical progression of the world on culture and Western civilization, this was before individualism was really starting to come out. This is post-Renaissance, but only within a century of the Renaissance's peak, which Michelangelo was there. And then individualism and relativism started to come. So to us today, where we're not, knowing who we're going to marry, from, let's say, 10 years old, or we have a career already chosen for us, or, following in the family business, to think of all these individual decisions that we get to make today, to judge the rest of our lives, where we want to live. I get to live in Italy, I got to say I wanted to marry this woman. I want to have, I'm on my fourth kid now, to make all these decisions was unheard of in really anywhere in the world prior to the last few centuries starting now. And so back in the 16th century, it was no exception. Whenever these young men especially if they didn't come from wealthy families, let's just take St. Robert Bellarmine, for example. He showed a religious promise from a very early age, and his mother Martha really encouraged that. But his father didn't, and his father takes a lot of heat, from his very, from the oldest biographers to the newest about this. But what I encourage readers to kind of see in a few different parts of the book, especially with St. Aloysius Gonzaga, is that, we have to really consider, first of all, the place and time that these people were, but not just that, but our own contemplation of our religious life, even as seculars and as lay people, is a very serious decision. Whenever you want to, if you're going to go with God, you got to go with God 100%. It doesn't mean that all of us have to be priests. I mean, if all of us were priests, we'd never have children, right? But so there's definitely, an opening for all that. But within the scope of that context, these young men had to make really important decisions. What's the future of this household if I'm the firstborn and I'm responsible for, the well-being of hundreds of people? Do I have a younger brother to take it over? Is he really qualified? How much younger than me is he? And when's dad gonna... when's dad not going to be able to do this anymore? Those are real considerations that they had to do. And the fathers here, I tried to my best to not let them be thrown under the bus, because now reading some of this text, like I pointed out, and nowadays it seems like, why on earth would they, stop them from doing this? Don't they know that this is the best they can be to the church, or, did they have some problem with God? But what we find out is that these fathers were deeply religious. They were just also concerned about the real state of the affair, which is, the finances of the family, the well-being, the health care, and taking care of these people so that the rest of the family can serve their vocation, which is, for some people, marriage, or another type of state of life. Yeah, that's kind of really all I wanted to say about that, you know, and I wanted to do that justice, you know, to stand up for the fathers of those men. But, you know, just to quantify it for the listeners out there, there's 10 saints in the book. I cover two women. And let me go through this. So let me just go through the ones whose fathers resisted their vocation. So we'll see if I can, you know, get off of one hand here. And that's so St. Francis de Sales. Yes, his father resisted. Who else is in the book? St. Robert Bellarmine, his dad resisted. St. Aloysius, his dad resisted. St. Borromeo, his dad, well, he comes from a long line of, in fact, a very powerful family, still with a lot of influence here in Italy. His father did not resist, to my knowledge. St. Philip Neri, his dad resisted. St. Pius V, no, he was given a religious vocation very early. His father didn't really resist. Who else am I missing? John of the Cross. I think it's unclear. I wouldn't say ambivalent, but his parents were probably encouraging of a religious vocation. And then the other one is Ignatius of Antioch. Yeah, I mean, he wanted to be a soldier. You know, he had to break a lot of family traditions, and then a lot of personal ambition that he had in his life. You know, he was probably the one who resisted it the most, not just his parents or anything. But these saints who got started in the clergy or priesthood really young, yeah, you can guarantee that their parents, their mother probably prayed for a vocation. You'll read about, and then their father. Usually resisted. So it's just an interesting dynamic to point out.
Very interesting. We're going to take another quick break and we'll be right back. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back with Sean McCaffrey. Stay tuned. Let bad coffee leave you bitter. Experience the pure taste of artisan small batch coffee with Grim Bean Coffee Company. Grim Bean's whole bean and ground coffee is sourced from 90 farms across the coffee belt from organic, fair trade, and direct trade farmers. With over 20 coffee selections, Grim Bean is sure to match your taste. Single purchase and subscription services delivered to you ensure that you will never be without your favorite coffee again. Visit GrimBeanCoffee.com today for 10% off your order with the code BREADBOX at checkout. Experience the best with Grim Bean Coffee Company. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and today we have Sean McCaffrey with us. We're talking about Reform Yourself, How to Pray, Find Peace, and Grow in Faith with the Saints of the Counter-Reformation. And we covered some serious ground last two segments, Sean. We're heading into the final two. And you keep bringing up this one saint. I didn't have him as part of my interview notes, but I'm going to bring him up, and that is because I have a feeling you have some kind of connection to him, and that's St. Robert Bellarmine, who you call our model apologist. So could you give us some background on him?
Yeah, he is one of my favorite to talk about, maybe because I know so much about him after reading, you know, for the last couple of years about him. But to me, he just has one of the most fascinating stories, and he was probably given the worst lot, you know, as far as a post-death what do you call it? Press, really, you know, PR.
PR.
You know, so he was probably given the worst PR out of all of them and totally undeserving of the recognition that went along with his name. Okay, so get started early. He comes from, if there was any town in Italy that's a Catholic town other than Rome and the Vatican, it's called Montepulciano, and it sits atop a little hill in Tuscany, and it's famous for its wine grapes now, but anybody who knows the Catholic history of this place will be just absolutely thrilled, because there's not just two canonized saints come from this little itty-bitty town. I'm telling you, like 10,000 people. But like five popes, 16 cardinals, and 30-something bishops come from little Montepulciano.
Wow.
Before St. Robert Bellarmine was canonized there, it was known, and it still is. I believe it's the pilgrimage of Saint Rita. She was a levitator, and a lot of people go there still for her pilgrimage. And so, anyways, he grew up in a very Catholic town. His father was not rich at all. I think he was just, you know, a local administrator. They didn't make a lot of money, but his mother was a part of the Medici family, and anybody that is a part of that family, you know, has some money. So at the early age, he showed a lot of academic progress or promise, and yeah, let's say progress too. And so his uncle, who was a cardinal, funded all his schools, and then he was elected pope and died, unfortunately, 1 month after being elected pope. And so all that money, unfortunately, went away, and they were like, well, what are we going to do to fund, you know, our oldest son who's really excelling in school? Well, then the Jesuits moved into town. And then the school was free, and the mother loved it, but the father was like, yeah, but don't you want him to be a doctor, you know, or a lawyer or something? I mean, he's got the skills and the brains to do anything he wants with his life. You know, why not just, you know, sink the money in? And so his parents went back and forth through his early life, not probably as bad as Saint Gonzaga, but they went back and forth at an early age. But his father finally conceded because he loved his wife so much. You know, he's like, you know, trusted her like Joseph trusted Mary, you know, and just, you know, just really started to encourage that academic vocation, yes, but also applied to a vocational sense. And that's where we really see the promise of St. Robert Bellarmine, was his great ability to be a fantastic preacher, world famous by the time he was about 25, let's say. He was known he was one of those in Italy you'll hear referred to as the child cardinal, because even by the time he was given, you know, a seat as a cardinal, he still looked incredibly young. And so there's actually a funny story. It's not in the book, I don't think, but there's a funny story coming out of his early years in preaching. Around the Tuscan area, where some lady is on her knees in the front row and she's praying the whole time. And after he gives a homily, he goes up to her, this lady, and he's like, well, you know, thank you for praying for me. Might I ask what you were praying about? And she said, I was praying to God that you would not embarrass our parish and the religious order that you represent. And so he's like stunned. And he's like, well, why? And she's like, because you're so young. You couldn't be past 18, right? And by this time, he's like 30-something, right? Huh. I only point that out. Like, he was known to preach like the most, you know, eloquent homilies, you know, far beyond his years, and he still looked like a little child. So it really wowed audiences, and his story goes on from there. He helped defend the church in England while it was still Catholic against James the First, and although there were a lot of atrocities there with a lot of martyrs there with the English priests, his defense of the Catholic Church allowed some political avenues of some suppression of some of the anti-Catholic laws at the time that were going on. He brought the church back into communion with the Venetians. The Republic of Venice was its own state at one point in time. Now, of course, it's a part of Italy, and before that, it was a part of the Papal States. And that's all due to St. Robert Bellarmine. His apologetic works are unsurpassed. His most famous of those is the I'm forgetting the name, but his most famous work is a three-volume series, and the first volume was over 1 million words. The second volume doubled that, and in total, these exceed almost 9,000 words, these three volumes. The average book these days, like my book, I think it has somewhere around 60,000 words, you know, maybe 70,000 words. To think that his first volume, which was published immediately and used all over the world for the defense of the Catholic faith, it still is. In fact, I just saw Jimmy Akin like buy a copy of it just a couple months ago.
Jimmy Akin's it's big league.
It's called The Controversies. I'm sorry. I didn't want to misquote it. I didn't want to call it The Confessions. It's The Controversies. And so all three volumes exceed almost 9 million words. It's just, it's absolutely, I can't even wrap my mind around how much, and I get to type on a keyboard. And I get to draft and edit and constantly edit. And he did all this with his hand, you know, or maybe with the help of a scribe, but he still, you know, is able to put forth the work there. And most of his works are still not available in anything other than the German that they were first translated to from Latin. So, I mean, the world still has yet to discover all of the, you know, the wonderful, you know, applications of the defenses that he did. He also helped reform the breviary. He helped reform the missal. He was the chief, writer or contributor to the new catechism that the Council of Trent called for. So it's called the Catechism of Trent, but really what it should be called is the Bellarmine Catechism. Because really, I mean, truly, he's the one who really put it into work and in publication. And the fascinating stories just go on from there. What happens is at the end of his life, the why I say he got a bad lot is he was the chief, he was the chief clerical point, you know, person who was responsible for delivering the verdicts to Galileo and the controversies that came out of that. He was there for the first run-in with Galileo. They call it an incident. He was there for the first incident, and it was kind of ugly. And, you know, really, you know, he was more of the messenger in that case. And then, as we know, like 15 years later, the church once again kind of came down on Galileo, and it was a lot more ugly then. But, you know, once the name sticks in history. Right. And so once Catholic people got a hold of the name Bellarmine, they drag it through the mud. They say he was responsible in all of these sessions to determine what the fate of Galileo was. And, you know, so he was the whipping boy for literally, I'm not making this up, 400 years. You know, if there is anybody who deserved to be canonized, and I don't say this to discredit all the other wonderful saints, but, you know, he deserved to be canonized just like the rest of them almost immediately. And due to bad PR and the church having to kind of dig its way out of what it did at the, midway through the 17th century with Galileo. You know, unfortunately, we weren't able to see his canonization until just within the last 100 years. One of my favorites, like you said, and not enough to, I could go on and on. We could do the rest of the segments about him.
All I'm going to say is somebody handwrote 9 million words. Kudos to them, because if you tried looking through 9 million of my handwritten words, you wouldn't even be able to read half of them.
Yeah, and your forearm, you'd be able to curl like a 1,000-pound dumbbell.
Right on. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be right back with Sean McAfee discussing his book, Reform Yourself, How to Pray, Find Peace, and Grow in Faith with the Saints of the Counter-Reformation. Hi, I'm Pete Sox, the host of Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Head on over to my show page at breadboxmedia.com and support my show and our work here at Breadbox Media by becoming a premium member today. And we believe it's more about giving than receiving. When you become a premium member for just $9.99 a month, you unlock incredible discounts from our sponsors like Rugged Rosaries, Catholic Books Direct, Lifeboat Coffee, the Mass Box, and the Harrisburg Senators, just to name a few. And it's even better. Every month, Breadbox Media chooses a nonprofit organization to partner with, and 10% of every premium membership is dedicated to that nonprofit. Join the revolution in Catholic media. Become a premium member by visiting my page today. Here on Breadbox Media, I'm your host, Pete Talks, Catholic Book Blogger. We've had a great couple segments here with Sean McCaffrey talking about his book, From the Catholic Answer to Reform Yourself, How to Pray, Find Peace, and Grow in Faith with the Saints of the Counter-Reformation. And Sean, one thing I want to point out to those of us listening is kind of the layout of this book. You go into these 10 saints, but what I think is really cool about it is you're honing in on how these saints from long ago can help us today. But you also give resources for further study on each of the saints. And then you also include a prayer to each of the saints. Now, I just think that's a really cool thing you did there.
Thank you. Yeah, I was wondering. Yeah, I had so many ideas for this book. And gratefully, the publisher accepted just about every one of them. I think just short of all color pages, but I was really, you know, Like I have said, I think in almost every segment, is I really just want this book to do its job. I didn't want to write an entertaining book. I didn't want to write a book that just gives a bunch of facts. I really wanted to write the book that I want to read, which is something that helps us all like really become effective evangelizers, apologists, students, lifelong students, and obviously. To convert towards Christ. So obviously we can't do that without praying and more study. So, you know, it just kind of went along with the theme. Well, it's like, okay, I don't just want you to stop with my book. Here's what you can keep on going with.
Right. For a lifelong habit of learning. Because I often say you're never going to possibly understand everything in the Catholic faith in your lifetime, because it's the Catholic faith to me is like a beach. You might pick up one grain of sand, but you got all those other grains of sand to dive into.
Yeah, I might steal that analogy. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
It's mine.
Darn, I didn't copyright it. So I want to talk about one more saint, I think, because sometimes when we talk about the faith, we tend to paint it as dull and bland and boring. And I thought it was really cool that you included, I'll start off with the subtitle you used for him, the Reformer of Solemn Humor, St. Philip Neri.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's said that Neri kept a book of jokes near his office. So joy and cheerfulness were obviously a central component of his life, were they not?
Yeah, they were. You can see this from some of the childish stories that we read in his childhood before, and much like the other ones. If you read a biography of the, you know, beginning to end of some of these saints, you'll realize, okay, these guys as children were pretty goofy too. You know, I mean, if somebody ever writes a book about you and me, I'll be red in the face before they, you know, are able to tell some of the stories. But, you know, starting from the earliest times of St. Philip Neri, he had nicknames. He was known as the really joyful kid. He was maybe somewhat of a practical jokester, but as he grew to become older, I think what he did was he didn't become, and I point this out in the book, is he's known as the, I think maybe even the patron saint of like humor or something like that. Everybody just knows that St. Philip Neri was the funny one. But, you know, after reading his biographies from people who knew him, Antonio Galonia was one of his disciples, you know, after reading those biographies, I found that there was actually very few stories of those moments where, you know, he's talking about a book of jokes or you know, he's just, you know, goofballing or something, or mm-hmm. you know. So, but what we where do we find the humor then in the life of Saint Philomere? I really had to dig around this, as I was, because I know his reputation, and I couldn't, you know, I didn't want to just write a chapter that just said, you know what, everybody's been wrong. He actually wasn't very funny. I was like, okay, well, what was funny? And so, and this is something I discuss in the book. Well, really, what was humor to somebody back then, and how did he use that? What made his, you know, what made his humor such an effective part of his evangelism, and even in his preaching, and the way in which he was a leader to this new religious order, the oratory. And so I can go over some of those things, but I think where we really find Saint Philomere is we find somebody who was willing to be, you know, he was willing to take on acts of humility in order to, first of all, increase his own holiness. So we read about him, we read about the famous shirt hair, the hair shirt that he wore around. So what is that? So sometimes back in the day, as an act of humiliation, and maybe even as a matter of punishment, like sackcloth and ash, mm-hmm. people used to get a shirt made of horse's hair and wear it on the outside of their clothing so that they would kind of look a little stupid. But at the same time, it would be really hot. So this was a way of like keeping really insulated. And in the summer, if you wore one, you were probably doing it as an act of mortification, maybe. But he would wear them, you know, when it didn't even make sense, like when the weather was perfect or something. And he, they would see it sticking out from underneath his clothes, not on the outside, you know, or you know, maybe even the opposite. They would be expecting them to keep it on the underside as an act of mortification. But he would wear it on the outside like it was a matter of fashion. And this would make people crack up, right? So, you know, like imagine just seeing somebody do that today. I mean, honestly, just like, or like, for example, like one time they, Antonio Galonio says that he showed up to mass to offer mass with half of his beard shaven. could you imagine like the hysteria that would go on? Like people would crack up, but what Saint Philomere, you know, and there's a quote, I don't have it memorized. It's almost like a paragraph long. I'm embarrassed. I can't memorize anything more than seven words. But no, St. Philomere, he has a quote that says something that basically undergirds the importance of not trying to look like you just know everything, you know, not taking yourself too seriously, giving people the impression that you, you know, are not just trying to get them to think the very best of you, you know, that you just want to be a humble human and go through life, you know, with a humble attitude. And his way of accomplishing that, this isn't for everybody, was a very extroverted sense of humor. He was definitely a person of the people. He expressed himself in ways that were very benign. And not really understood to the culture that was in Rome at the time. And back then, those weird things that he did where people were like, what on earth is you know, Philip doing these days, you know, Father Filippi doing these days? You know, those are ways that he, you know, mortified himself with the use of humor in order to increase humility and therefore increase holiness. And so, yeah, that's what I tried to say in the book, you know, right. Was to say, OK, well, you know, he didn't do this just to be a comedian and gain laughs. And that was what he was famous for. He did it with a purpose. And so that's what I took away from him. And I hope readers can, too.
Right. And I got to share this. And this humor of his, you know, continued even upon his death. You include this paragraph, and I'm going to quote this. People witnessed his humor even immediately after his death, when he appeared to a devout virgin woman in a dream and had a lengthy conversation with her. When the banter became trivial, he said to the woman, "Let me continue on my journey. You've delayed me long enough." What's ironic and true to Philip's sense of humor is that the woman did not know Philip was deceased until the next day, when she told the story to members of his society. But Philip, having died and now being outside of time and space, made a reference to his tardiness as if that mattered.
Yeah. Yeah, it was exactly like that. He's just, he did things like that. And you can kind of see what I'm talking about. It wasn't necessarily like, you know, Jerry Seinfeld up there trying to make everybody laugh. He used these humorous occasions to highlight something bigger. And in that case, it was a matter of prophecy. I can't remember the exact story, but it was a matter of comforting this woman who had just recently lost her deceased husband or something. And he said, okay, now don't worry about me. I got to go get a bunch of other stuff done now. But obviously at that time, you know, so in retrospect, it was humorous. And at the time, it was trying to be comforting.
Right, right. Now, as we wind down here, Sean, I want to give you an opportunity to speak about some other things. And one of those is your work at Epic Pew. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Sure. Epic Pew is a very important piece of my heart. We started it, and I say we because it belongs to the writers. I just kind of, I kind of became the quarterback of this team here. It's a website that we started back in 2014 in November. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to kind of create a different website for the Catholic community, where we share, you know, really fun, really, I guess, humorous and popular content. So at Epic Pew, readers who are unfamiliar, what can you expect when you go there? You're going to find, you know, really good videos that are going around the internet that you might not have seen yet. We have original quizzes, you know, like one of our popular quizzes is can you tell if this saint was a friar or not a friar, you know, or something like that. We also have lists, you know, really funny lists, and some are really important lists. Like we'll talk about anything from the top of 10 accomplishments of John Paul II to 10 things you should never say to a priest, you know. So and they're very witty. I think I contributed a lot amount of time in the first couple of years that Epic Pew was getting its tread started, but now we have a very diverse and gifted group of writers who contribute, and they pump out content every day, and it's still very fresh. We talk about the news, but it's not anything you have to spend more than what I tell all the writers is write something that readers don't have to spend more than 48 seconds on.
Yeah.
Why 48? I don't know, but it's a statistic. They say that people usually don't stay on a website for more than 30 seconds at a time. So I said, hey, look, if that's the case, then let's give something very quick, very effective, you know, as a quick means of evangelizing somebody's day, maybe giving them a smile or giving them something to think about, and doing it in a wholesome Catholic way.
Awesome. Now, throughout the segments here, you alluded to some possible other book projects. Are you at liberty to discuss any of those today?
Yeah, sure. The one I'm working on now is one I've actually been working on since even before this Reform Yourself was even started. And that's it's a book on the magisterium of social media and its context within the Catholic Church. And this is a really hard book to write. Maybe why it's taken so long is I'm trying to go through pains to make this very relevant for readers. And so what the basic gist of the book is what is the proper use of social media in light of what the magisterium tells us? What is the magisterium? That's the papal documents from Vatican II. One of the first day or the first two documents that came out actually on the same day, where one had to do with the media, that's Inter Mirifica, and the other had to do with worship, and that's Sacrosanctum Concilium. And as I discussed with a professor one time, Dr. Mahfoud, who's practically my spiritual guide, he pointed out to me that those two came out on the same day to really orient the church on what the purpose of Vatican II was and what the mission of the church is. One says how to talk to God, that's worship, and the other says how to talk to the world, and that's the media. And so this book kind of goes along with the call of Inter Mirifica, and you know, what is the proper use of the media these days? What ways might it be, you know, absolutely damning upon us, and what ways can we really use it to evangelize effectively? And so, yeah, a lot of books have come out on it, and I'm trying to make this one really different. So that's one project I've got going that'll come out with En Route Books and Media. I don't know, hopefully in 2018. I'm also working on it's pretty much already written. I just got to run through it and edit it. And this is kind of my memoir that I kept when I was deployed to Afghanistan from 2015 to 2016. And mm-hmm. I kind of kept a secret journal that I didn't really tell anybody but my wife about. And it'll be really short. I plan to just self-publish this one. Probably won't even ask for, you know, a dollar on it. unless it goes to somebody like Wounded Warriors or something. Mm-hmm. But it's just a spiritual memoir that I kept while I was deployed, kind of talking about what life was like there, and, you know, what it was like to, you know, have faith away from the family and away from my country, you know, while being challenged spiritually and being challenged mentally. I've got so many on the docket, Pete. One more I'll tell you about is one I haven't even gotten started on, other than drawing a general outline on, and I don't have a publisher for this one or really anything yet, but it's something I'm really excited about. It's a book tentatively titled His and Hers, and this is something that I wanted to write with my wife for a while. She blogs at Epic Pew, and she's got a wonderful Catholic story to share, and also she's what are they called? An NFP practitioner. Okay. With the Pope Pius the Sixth, Pope Paul the Sixth Institute. So she teaches young couples about NFP. So mm-hmm. What we want to do is give men, young men and women, especially men though, something to read about the pro-life movement and the involvement of NFP in the married life. So we don't really know exactly what's going to go into that right now, but that's the basic gist is my wife and I are hopefully going to complete a book here within the next year. It'll be titled right now we're thinking His and Hers. So guys will have something to read, and that's kind of unprecedented. A lot of guys don't talk about NFP. Mm-hmm. And then the girls will have something to read as well.
Awesome. Well, that's all we have time for today. Sean, before we go, I want to give you a chance to tell people where they can find your work.
Oh, okay. Most of my work happens at the National Catholic Register. I write there once a week in a blog. I do a lot of work, at least one article with Catholic Answers a month. And then, like you said, epicpew.com or SeanMcAfee.com. If you just Google my name, Sean McAfee, you'll find it. That's where you can find just about all my work. But Pete, I don't want to have the last word. I want to tell you thank you. You're a great friend, and I appreciate you doing this for me.
No problem. Anytime. And I got to have you back on about that memoir from Afghanistan. We have to talk about that. So you let me know when that's public.
Okay.
All right. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.